We've been talking about how conservatives are getting played.
Okay. Okay. So you and I are on the same page. All right. Go ahead.
And I'm just watching it happen. And I feel like there's nobody that people's memory is so short.
How do you think conservatives are getting played?
Well, one, I don't see anyone refusing to use critical race theory. It's become people just assume it now.
Oh, bro. Okay. Can I?
You got pushed so hard.
Yes.
And we were like, oh, this is the worst. And now we're like, well,
hold on. We'll use it.
Now it's a tool in our tool belt.
What if I told you that you and Michael Fallon are agreeing with each other?
Oh, that'd be amazing.
Yeah, you guys actually are. This is really amazing on more than one level. So hold on. Critical race theory. I don't want to forget this. CRT, conservatives agree. Because here's where I'm going to take this. And I'm not a brilliant guy. I'm not that smart. I'm really not. And the more the people listen to this podcast, they figure out who the smart one is here. It's not hard to figure out. Actually, just a couple of moments listen to this podcast. But there's a few things that I think are brilliant about what's about to happen. If I can pull this up. Oh, so I sent you something. Okay, good. It's here. Yes, it's here. I sent you something. Oh, this is going to be challenging. But I think I can do it because I'm doing it live. It's a little more challenging. But I sent you something. What was it? Last night or the night before?
The J. Cole
apology? Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. I sent you something last night. And this is really important to this conversation. So I don't know how many people listen to our show that are like us. Does that make sense?
I don't know how you categorize right, us. Yeah.
Black. So. I don't know many people that are black like us. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, and what I mean by that is like, it's not just black. It's like, there's in the culture, like we, there's a certain vibe. We are always kind of in the flow of what's going on in hip hop, what's going on in the culture. Kind of like the history can go back. We're connected to that. Like we're one of the few conservatives that are out there that like don't flinch a Black History Month. Like we appreciate it. Like you got conservatives out there arguing about Juneteenth and we're like, no, it's ours. Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
We
just don't want the government to be the one that comes along and says you can have it on the plantation.
Right. Exactly. Or trying to own the plantation. I think we're way more, we unlike two different groups, conservatives or liberals, or Republicans or Democrats. I think we look at Black history as being American history, not so much separate from American history, which it's kind of funny. People say that, but they don't believe that because then we start talking about it. They only want to talk about the kind of Black history that makes them feel good, which is kind of weird. But I never went and looked through the history of America with Black history and felt so good. I feel like, man, we were stupid. So, you know, I look at it, and I'm like, we were stupid. And I have to, Apple's giving me a thumbs up. And then I go back and be like, man, we're stupid now. Killing babies in the womb. Like, that's stupid. And it just so happens the majority of the babies that were killing the womb are Black babies.
Right.
That's just stupid.
And we keep voting for the people that tell us that celebrate that.
Okay. So when something happens, I don't have a whole lot of people I can throw this to, but I'm going to try and add this to the screen. But I've been paying attention to the J. Cole and Kendrick Lamar, and then you got Drizzy in there as well. You know, I don't know what happened. I mean, this kind of been boiling up to a point with these three. They call them the big three, right? And I think Kendrick Lamar just hit a nerve and he was done. Like, he's like, I'm going to say what I need to say. And it's been kind of quiet inside the hip hop game. We ain't had no real beef battles, really. Drizzy Drake and that was the last one. So everybody's ear kind of opens up when you get a battle.
Yeah.
So
I was actually talking to my barber about this.
Barber?
Yeah. About it's hard to tell. Are they just trying to stay relevant or is it real? Because my barber was like, it's a good way to stay relevant, but it makes me wonder if it's real.
Is your barber black?
Yeah.
Okay. Yep, thought so. I was just wondering. Okay, I hope I can play this because I'm not logged in, but I'm going to try and play this. So let me set this up. So you got, and this is all relevant. This is right to your point. And this is why I thought this was really important. And this is why I think this is kind of brilliant because it works right with our conversation. So Kendrick Lamar comes out with a diss track to Drizzy and J. Cole. Internet goes bonkers. Ain't been this much hype around hip hop in a long time, right?
Yes.
So then J. Cole comes in the studio. He's got a new record dropping, right? And he comes in the studio and he drops 7 minutes.
7 minutes.
In 7 minutes. And when I say the boy's bad, the boy is bad.
He's not pulling any punches.
He says he does. But you're right. He's not pulling any punches. He just goes ham. Like for 7 minutes, literally, they said the dude came in the studio and in 7 minutes wrote this. All right. So you can go find and listen to it if you want to, all you hip hop heads out there. That's fine. But that's not
the last. It's the last song on his newest album.
Which is, lets you know, it was the last song.
It was the last song. Yeah. It was added after the fact, I expect.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm trying to see if I can get all this in there. There we go. All right, so I'm going to try and play you. So he's at a concert. He's doing – here's right here. J. Cole speaks up about his response to Kendrick Lamar at the Dreamville Fest and says it hasn't felt good or right with his spirit. Interesting that he uses that frame. What are y'all's thoughts? So I just want to – this is the context of how he starts talking about this, if I can pick it up. Here we go. Here he goes.
Except for one part.
Okay. This is, you're not hearing that because it's not playing through. Let me see if I can get
it. I can hear it.
Oh, could you hear
it? Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I didn't hear that part. Let me see if I can. All right. Let's see if it plays through now.
It's one part of that shit that make me feel like, man, that's the lamest.
Can you hear it?
Yep.
Okay. I'm going to tell everybody, I didn't beat this out. This is going to be full language. So if you can't handle it, you got to turn. But if you can, you can keep listening. All right, I'll try it again.
Shit I ever did in my fucking life, right? And I know this is not what a lot of people want to hear. I know I can hear my niggas up there right now like, nah, don't do that. But I got to keep it 100 with y'all, right? I damn near had a relapse, right? Because y'all heard some shit that happened two, 3 weeks ago, however long it was. Y'all heard that bazooka that was dropped on the motherfucking game, right? So all of this time of me moving on my own accord, for the first time I was tested. Why am I tested? Because I got the world and I got my niggas like, what you gonna do, Cole? My niggas like, bitch, boy, I must have had 1,000 missed calls. Oh my fucking God. Text flooded. I couldn't even answer my shit. Nigga, it's wartime. Niggas want to see blood. And I was conflicted because, one, I know my heart, you know what I mean? And, like, I know how I feel about my peers, these two niggas that I just been blessed to even stand beside in this game, let alone chase their greatness, right? So I felt conflicted because I'm like, bro, I know I don't really feel no way. But the world want to see blood. I don't know if y'all can feel that, but the world want to see blood. So I say all of that to say, in my spirit of trying to like get this music out, I ain't gonna lie to y'all. I moved in a way that I feel spiritually bad on me.
Like, spiritually.
Like I try to like jab my nigga back and I try to keep it friendly. But at the end of the day, when I listen to it and when it comes out and I see the talk, that shit don't sit right with my spirit. That shit make me feel, that shit disrupts my fucking peace. So what I want to say right here tonight is in the midst of me doing that and in that shit, trying to find a little angle and downplay this nigga's fucking catalog and his greatness. I want to say right now tonight, how many people think Kendrick Lamar is one of the greatest motherfuckers to ever touch a fucking microphone?
Wow.
Yeah.
Dreamville, y'all love Kendrick Lamar, correct?
Wow.
As do I. So I just want to come up here and be like, publicly be like, bro, that was the lamest, like, goofiest shit. And I say all that to say, it made me feel like 10 years ago when I was moving incorrectly. And I pray that God align me back up on my purpose and on my path. You know what I mean? I pray that my nigga really didn't feel no way. And if he did, my nigga, I got my chin out. Take your best shot. I'm going to take that shit on the chin, boy. Do what you do. You know what I mean? Like, all good. Like, it's love. And I pray that, you know, I pray that y'all are like, forgive a nigga for like the misstep, and then I can get back to my true path, because I ain't gonna lie to y'all.
Oh, okay. Okay, hold on.
Past 2 days felt terrible. Like, it let me know how good I've been sleeping for the past 10 years. So all of that to say, man, I wanna now perform the song that's a reminder to me of getting back on the right path and getting in tune with God. And the name of the song is called Love Yours. I wanna do that for y'all right now.
Okay. Woo! So there's a lot to say about that. I mean, I'm gonna look over a large portion of that and get to the thing that I want to talk about with this. Cause there's a lot. There's so much religiosity in there. There's so much going on, but I never seen this before where the battle is just starting. You know what I'm saying? I gotta get this gun out of my mouth.
Yeah. I mean,
so
it reminds me of Snoop at the BET Awards.
Yep. Okay. When? Which one?
When things were heating up and it was getting, they were out there, and he said, and he got up and just said,
"Y'all got no love for
Got no love for the West Coast.
Y'all got no love for the West Coast. Y'all got no love for Dre. Y'all got no love for Snoop.
Because we love y'all, right? So you have." But that was after it had escalated to a point when they started getting nervous.
You know how many records dropped though?
Right. They started getting nervous. Something was going to go wrong.
I mean, even then,
and that's before the CIA killed Biggie and Tupac, but that's another thing.
Again, we're going to let some of this slide, cause we got to get to the, but here's the deal. So looking at all this, cause I actually think this is far more radical than that moment, because this has been a week.
Yeah.
Kendrick Lamar drops his stuff. You know, J. Cole, Drake ain't even did nothing yet. Not publicly that we know about, said nothing. He ain't even said nothing yet. So J. Cole comes in here and fires off, and whatever bazooka that was used by Kendrick, Drake dropped a nuke. And then he comes back a few days after he dropped the nuke and says, "Dang, I shouldn't have dropped the nuke." Yeah. And so, like, I look at this and I'm like, it hasn't even really got started yet, right? And I'm like, these guys, and I don't want to take anything from them on their talent, but these guys are cut a little different than I remember the OGs being cut from, because there was no way that LL Cool J was going to come back and be like, "Oh, I'm sorry."
Right.
There was no way. Look, there's no way Will Smith was going to come back and be like, "My bad, I shouldn't have." There was no way. Rakim was going to come. There's no way. Yeah. There's all these guys who were battling. You were going to have to deal with it. Matter of fact, battles were just, that's what it was on the street. Like, you had to come back. You ain't going to fire off on the street and be like, "My bad, dude." So like, the question I have, and this goes right to your, what you were asked, what you were talking about, us taking the bait, because the industry wants this so bad. And so has J. Cole gotten soft in the whole rap industry, in one sense, in the culture? Has J. Cole gotten soft, or is he actually in the place where he's doing the right thing, not taking the type of bait that they want him to take so that they get their blood? Because if you're a gladiator in, I see you smirking, you already know your answer. So if you're a gladiator and you don't give the people blood, you don't survive. The people act like they don't want blood. That's a crap. How everybody's going to respond? He's like, "Hey man, my chin's out, bro. If you want to come after me again, cause I did that, you got it. I ain't going to say nothing. I'm done. I'm not going to get in this anymore. You got it. My bad. Bro, I shouldn't have got into it the first time. I ain't slept well. I've been sleeping good for 10 years and this made me not sleep well for the first time." It's like, well, you're in war. Like, you don't sleep well in war. That's not what you're supposed to do. But he ain't been in war so long. So what do you think? Like, has he gotten soft, or is he not taking the cosmological bait? Yeah. Is he not taking that?
I think what he did is he said there are forces that want a blood feud, right? There are forces that are looking for a scapegoat.
My people.
Yeah.
Everybody else in the media, like everybody wants
it. Yeah, everybody around, but the media, I think, you know,
scapegoat.
Looking for a scapegoat, right? And he sees the mechanism, and instead of pointing at somebody else and saying, "Hey, that guy should be the scapegoat. Let's all gather together and go after him." He jumps into the mechanism himself and reveals it, right? And reveals it. So and he says, "I know this might end with me being the one that gets smacked around, you know, whatever, but I'm not playing the game." And this is because the game is not just it's a way that the culture refuses to look. It's the way that the culture shuts its eyes to problems. The scapegoat mechanism is the way that the culture that a group of people shut their eyes to the actual problems by grabbing a scapegoat and blaming, you know, pointing and, you know, looking for blood, looking for conflict. And it's a way of minimizing the actual source of the conflict down to something you can't see by maximizing something else that's not really the source of the conflict and putting it in front of the actual source of the conflict. Right. So I don't know if you saw the Ice Cube interview recently where he was talking.
You saw an Ice Cube interview and you didn't send it to me?
I know. I'm sorry, man. I should have.
How many other black friends you got, bro? Like, for real.
You're my only black friend. I promise. Well,
you're barber now.
Why am I barber yet?
That's funny.
But he was just talking about how there's within hip hop, there's a layer above the artists that wants to make sure that certain narratives get pushed for the black community, right? And he said because the people that bought the rights to a lot of hip hop songs also own the prisons.
Yeah, I heard about. Well, we knew that.
So he went into detail about how it works on an interview recently about how the system works, because he said, you know, it's not like he said there are he has been there when people have gotten lyrics delivered from some mysterious place. he's like, no, where'd the lyrics come from? Right. You got somebody's helping write lyrics. He said, but most of the time it has to do with the marketing. It has to do with the, you know, what gets pushed, what gets pushed up the ladder, what gets celebrated by the marketing teams in order to keep anyone from looking at, you know, looking up the line and saying, well, you know, there's this problem up the line that's causing all sorts of troubles, right?
So what you're saying is that hip hop has its own Dr. Fauci.
It does, yeah.
Right. And, like, that's what it is. And which ain't nothing new. We always knew that.
Right, But there are certain guys that have, you know, there's always been a stream of hip hop that is more aware, right? The Black Thought guys, the Black Star,
the neo soul folks,
the neo soul. But J. Cole, he's been in that.
He came out,
and they're trying to pull him in.
Here's a good point,
and he's refusing, right?
He hadn't before. I mean,
but when he says, like, the last 10 years I've been sleeping well, you can see the trajectory of his change, you know, and some of it, you know, you make some money and you move into the suburbs or you move to the middle class, you know, because he's not at the Dre level, you know, he's not a billionaire, but he's definitely making enough money. You know, it's like there's a really great book called Real Artists Don't Starve that does a business history of Ice Cube. and it's brilliant. It just
wasn't that Rakim's book. Was that
Rakim? No, Rakim's book was good too, but that one was on the on creativity.
Oh,
this
yeah.
This is a business book.
I have that one.
And yeah. It shows it, and it goes through different businessmen, and Ice Cube's one of them. And it shows how Ice Cube, the difference between Eazy and Ice Cube was they made the same money, right? They made the same, but Eazy-E, he had no self-control. He had no dad. He had no family structure. He had nothing. And so he basically just had sex with anything that moves and did drugs, you know, drunk, whatever he could do to escape the existential pain of his displacement, right? That was how Eazy-E used his money. Ice Cube invested it. He got married. He moved his kids to a neighborhood with the school that he wanted them at. It was the same thing with Chris Rock's new special talking about sending his kids to a Parisian school in Paris, right? He's like, because, you know, he's trying to make it, he's getting his kids out of the system that he was raised in, because it was dehumanizing, right? So Ice Cube, he turned down an enormous offer financially because he saw that it kept him it forced him to stay where he was, and he wanted to raise his kids some other place.
Jeff Goins is the guy who wrote.
Yeah. Right. It's a great book. It's 10 different artists and the way that they build businesses around their creative endeavors. It's really
did he
book.
Hit Master P on that? He had to hit Master
no,
P.
No, he didn't. But Master P is one of my business heroes for the same reason. Yeah. Because he said, because he's the one that taught everybody, because hip hop actually, it's because of guys like Master P that hip hop actually grew up. Right.
That's right. That's
rock right. and roll never grew up. It becomes easy listening music. It doesn't
became
stay
folk.
Rock and roll and grow up. Yeah. You had folk music. You had all sorts of things, but rock and roll stayed. It stayed 16 years old, you know, 16, 17 years old. Well, guys like Master P and Ice Cube, they Dr. Dre, they took their money and they said, I'm moving out of this. I'm moving out of here. I'm reinvesting it, and my kids are not going to have the life that I had. Right, my kids are going to have a different life. And you know, shows like Black AF should make a comedy out of it. But the reality is, once you get an opportunity to see, like Ice Cube did, this we're being used. Like they're paying us to play a role in a cultural transformation that they want to make, right? And so he got out, started making family movies, basically, you know, with his money instead of rapping. He didn't
make Menace to Society 3 right? Or anything like that. He made a family film.
He woke up and said, man, I'm making Are We There Yet to First Sunday, you know, everything is about how to transition, you know, all of the movies that he made were stories about how to transition out of fatherless ghetto life into a family that's functioning well, where the dad is, right? Like that became the story that he wanted to tell. It's, you know, similar who's the guy that he did Elf and he oversaw he did Beautiful Girls when he was young, got a little bit older and he made Elf, and he made, you know, because he was raised by a single dad. So every story he tells is about the importance of fatherhood, right? About honoring fatherhood and building up fatherhood. And, you know, Ice Cube's really similar. Every story he tells is because he had a dad that was active in his life, but he saw all of his friends without dads and said, I'm going to lean against that problem. I'm going to tell dads, I'm going to tell men that being a dad is actually the most important thing that you could do, right? So all of his movies, that's what they end up being about as he gets older, is magnifying fatherhood, because he can see that that's the difference between all his friends that ended up in jail and dead and the people that survived. So is fatherhood. So that refusal to, and J. Cole, he's doing something similar. He's like, I'm not, this system is destructive. And I can see that they want blood. They want this beef. And that there's a way that I could lean into it that might make me relevant. Right. And so he kind of does that. And then he's like, but man, that's not good. That's actually a destructive thing.
Yeah, I guess there's, if it wasn't Jay, I'd probably be like, oh, he's getting soft. But Jay gains to earn way more money from this battle, this beef, than he does from not doing it.
Right.
Right. And he gains to lose people from not doing it than he does from doing it. Right. And he knows that he's going to have all this. And so way more attention, especially on the release of an album. Right. Because he knows everybody's waiting for him. So it's I would say, oh, man, he's getting soft. Now, I think there's an element to getting soft that's there, too. I don't want to say that there's not. But in J. Cole trying not to take the bait that's being given him. And let's just say I completely agree with you on this. Let's just say I follow you through on that. How is it that the conservatives now will pull a move like J. Cole? Because what is the bait that you see as being given us in that we are all thinking in buying into critical race theory in the conservative movement?
I think it's that you've got all of this. You've got all of this cultural meltdown, right? Civilizational meltdown. The civilization is being is rotting, right? And we don't want to be the ones that say, you know, this is our responsibility. We should do something about this, and lean back or resist or push back against the destruction of Western civilization. What critical race theory does is say, hey, it's not your fault. It's their fault. Those guys over there, it's the Jews, or it's the racial mixing, or it's there's a racial animosity that is fed that as a way of getting in between us and the actual problem, which is covenant breaking. Right. The actual problem is covenant faithlessness. But that is off in the distance, and critical race theory places something between us and them. Now,
so it puts the antithesis in the wrong spot.
Yeah. Right? It creates an antithesis that isn't unnecessary or isn't real or is created in order to hide the actual problem, to keep us from addressing the actual problem.
But there really is a actual problem, and everybody knows it, but they don't have a category or where to place it at.
Right. And the reason that critical race theory works is because we've bought into the Machiavellian understanding of civilization,
right?
That civilization is held together by some sort of power structure, that civilization doesn't grow out of reality, right? It's held together by a power structure. And when civilization falls apart, or when a new civilization is growing up, we look around and say, where's the power structure? Who's hiding the power structure, right? So, I mean, this is the reason that Hitler's propaganda worked, right? Because living things don't rot, right? And German civilization was rotting. And they started saying, who's causing the rot, right? Well, the death is what's causing the rot, right? The rot is because the civilization had turned away from the heart of life, which is trust in the resurrection of Jesus, right? Believing in the resurrection of Jesus, the spirit of God is the spirit of resurrection. The spirit of Christ, the spirit that rose Christ from the dead, is the spirit of resurrection, the spirit of life, life-giving reality. And they had turned away from the spirit, and they were trusting instead in the German spirit, right? That became the thing that they, you know, that they looked at and said, but somebody's trying to hold back the German spirit, like an octopus, you know, pushing back against everything. And Hitler just leaned right into it. I mean, he may have actually even believed it himself that it was, I have my doubts, because there was a significant financial benefit to arresting all the Jews, because they held all the debt of Germany. So I think it was easier to arrest them to pay back the than to pay back the debt. Right. But the reason that propaganda worked is because the you can't live without an organizing principle. And so the offer of critical race theory as an organizing principle is as a purely Machiavellian organizing principle, that you've got at the base of it, you've got rivalry between groups, you've got a limited amount of resources, you've got fight for those resources between us and them, and the us is a visual category, right? It's a category that's purely decided on with science, with DNA, with skin color, with the kind of, you know, what kind of hair grows out of your head, right? It's easy to identify in a scientific setup. You say, everybody is taken by sight rather than by faith. There's this fundamental rivalry over limited resources.
So
that Machiavellian power structure ends up creating the civilization. And so somebody's coming in and trying to put a different Machiavellian power structure in place, whether it's through conspiracies, whether it's through forcing it through media, where, you know, whatever it is, with the school system, someplace that they are, that there's a somebody trying to implement or put in a different power structure. And if we don't fight back and fight for our power structure, then their power structure is going to win, and they're going to end up with the resources, and we're going to end up without.
So then you get, it's funny as you said that, you know, no, I like the way you said it. No one can live without an organizing principle. So the organizing principle, a cosmology, right? Is that fair enough to say? Yeah. Comes into play. And then from that, you start getting a taxonomy.
Right.
It reorganizes humans into certain divisions and classes so we can identify who's who or what camp very quickly.
Right.
And so, and that's really interesting. So then, the conservatives then, I guess you haven't gotten to this part. So then can you, what's the current American organizing principle you believe is critical race theory?
I think that's becoming the new one, right? So the old one was classism, right? And that was because the conservatives are now, you hear this all the time. People say, well, it's not this isn't a race issue. This is a financial issue.
Economic issue.
Communism. Yeah. That's
interesting.
Conservatives are now defending communism. That is a way we've embraced the last critical race theory that was pushed on us, and now we're defending the communistic understanding. We're defending Marxism over against critical race theory, and calling critical race theory Marxism because it's trying to replace last generation's Marxism that the conservatives are defending.
So how is observing the challenges between the two economic realities, how is that communism?
Because it's assuming a limited resource system. Right, closed system with limited resources, and that there's a rivalry between the different classes, and that is what pushes society into its shape.
And so we're more comfortable with that one because that's the one we've been. So if we were fighting that, when do we stop fighting that and start embracing that?
So that started getting pushed on us in the 60s. I mean, it showed up on American shores in the 20s, really. And then it started getting pushed the following generation in the 60s really hard from the underground, from the fringes. And then through media, universities, different places. And then it was fully embraced by the 90s. So the 80s was where the fight happened. And they started calling it Reaganomics. They started calling it, they used things, terms like Reaganomics. They used all kinds of issues of the, you know, you have the breakdown of all of these different.
The war on poverty, is that systems, one of those?
The war on poverty, you know, conservatives were basically distracted by the fact that the USSR was gaining power and that there was a significant, you know, there was a real chance that you could have nuclear war, right? So that was a growing threat. What ends up happening is you have this revolution happening in the next generation, and the conservatives say, but we have to fight in Korea, we have to fight in Vietnam, or the USSR is going to gain a critical advantage.
Wow, sounds like Ukraine right now.
Right. This, you're going to get a critical. They're going to gain a critical advantage, and we're not going to be able to fight. Right. And so, but the next generation is saying, we don't know why we're fighting. Right. We don't know why you're sending us to war. You have not explained to us. Right. But it's because they have the shift has happened in a generational breakdown. Right. So the next generation. The people came back from World War II. There was a significant Christian revival coming home from World War II, especially in places like Alcoholics Anonymous, which started as a Christian, very Christian organization. You know, there was real revival amongst the men in those sorts of settings.
You get Boys and Girls Club coming out of this. YMCA. Yeah.
YMCA, Awana. Right. Right, you have real, actual, significant revival, large-scale conversion, but they're converted into really churches that are already going liberal, right? So the revival isn't amongst the clergy, and that's what is the problem, is you don't have significant revival amongst the clergy. It's all amongst the men in the culture without the clergy really embracing this new evangelicalism. So so because of that, you've got all of these kids that are still raised in public schools, still raised in in a system that's not Christian. And so you get a big divide. And there are all these first generation Christians. So they're raising their kids in church, but they're not getting any teaching about how to be parents, how to be families. You know,
Christianity devoid of actual real world practicality.
Real world practicality. Yeah.
And you got, don't forget now, by this time too, you have a huge rise in dispensational theology that starts to separate. And it's perfect. And this is not an accident, because you have the separate world views, this dichotomy between the world we live in, Christianity, the gospel, and politics and society. Yeah. These two things, which is kind of weird, because we're just now coming out of the civil rights movement, which is merging those two things together.
But communism is a separate eschatology, right? Communism is an eschatological religion. And so when you have a Christianity that doesn't have an eschatology, or if it does, it has a Machiavellian eschatology, communism comes in with an eschatology, right? So when you'll hear phrases like late stage capitalism, or stage 3 or stage 4 capitalism, right? Because Marx and Engels, who was translating the drunken ramblings of Karl Marx. Marx had this theory that that the economic systems of man, which were the defining feature, man was homo economus. He was a money making creature, and that's what needed to be fixed about him. That he would go through that mankind as a whole, as a corporate unit, would go through phases, right? So it went through tribal phase, then it went through imperial phase, and then it went, these different phases. And right now we were in the capitalist phase, but there were three phases or four phases, depending on the kind of Marxism, to capitalism. And then it would fall apart into a revolution that brought about socialism, and that socialism that could then be transformed into communism. It was an eschatology, right, that Marx was pitching or bringing. It was a practical evolutionary eschatology, and the source of the evolutionary energy was economic rivalry. Right, that was the source of the energy that brought about the millennial reign of corporate man.
Would that be at the core of itself envy then?
Yeah, envy. So envy is the individual experience, how the individual experiences it. But the rivalry between classes is the engine. Right. That's the engine. And so the envy is kind of the gasoline that the individual brings into that engine. But the engine itself it functions as long as you can keep the people envious. Right. So that system becomes an assumed system in the next generation. So once you push that through and you really divide the two separate the generations, the World War II generation, the baby boomer generation, they're divided from one another. And then a divided generation turns around and raises the next generation. And one of the still that the baby boomers raise the next generation divided by divided from themselves by their own sexual guilt, really, is what it comes down to. So they still married, they still had children, they still had families, but they didn't. They had never really dealt with, they did that out of habit, out of cultural habit, not really out of conviction, the way the previous generation did. And so when you have so they raise kids, and you have really the sexual revolution that finally takes root and takes place in the 90s, which is kids raised by people that had been separated from their parents, kids now raised by parents that have two incomes in a one income economy, latchkey kids. You have this major problem. That's when you suddenly see the downturn in marriage rates. You had started to see that in the really in the 80s in the Black community.
Oh no, 60s.
60s is where the Moynihan. Okay.
You got the Moynihan report that comes out in 60 or 64, something like that. And the Moynihan report is just expressing the downfall of the Black community and says, like, and it's going to be contagious. It's not something you're going to be able to stop. So he's seeing the breakdown of the Black family back in the 60s. So I think your timeline is dead on about what you see by the time you hit to the 80s and the 90s is already a generation of they're raised by that first generation of people who haven't had families anymore, because it's already collapsing. And the Moynihan reports are trying to say, hey, this is how we try and restore it. And I think it just missed the target on what the problem really was and all this stuff. But yeah, you start seeing it way back before that even.
Yeah. Well, so you have, the late 70s and the early 80s is when you have in the cities, you have the first generation of fatherless kids.
Mm.
Right. And that fatherlessness, that's where the punk rock revolution comes out of that fatherlessness. The hip hop revolution comes out of that fatherlessness, right? You have the, this entire,
65. Yeah. So you got in 65, the Moynihan Report.
So that's the breakdown of the family, he starts noticing the lack of marriage. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. So yeah, the Moynihan Report is when he starts seeing the breakdown of the black families in marriage. Correct.
Yeah.
And he's acknowledging that it's happened way before now. Right.
Yeah.
But yeah. So he acknowledges it's been happening, and he's tracing it to the welfare system that has been going on. And he's like, it's creating more of this. And so, he acknowledges that it's creating a whole culture of people who aren't going to stay married or be married because of the welfare system that's coming in place.
Right. And so in the cities, you have the breakdown, and then the next generation, it moves to the suburbs, and the next generation, it moves out to the rural areas.
Mm.
Right. So you have this wave of fatherlessness that just keeps moving further and further out from the city centers, which is where they were able, because everybody was gathered together, they were able to implement subsidization of the breakdown of the family. Right now, the reason that they can implement that isn't, they don't, it helps destroy the family, but you wouldn't be able to implement if the family wasn't rotting from the inside already. And that's because the family has been separated from worship, right? That the heart of the family is no longer found by going to church together, right? Right. As you know, and so the reason that it rots is because it's dead. Right. And so the rotting happens over time, but the death happens when the church ceases to find itself in the presence of the life-giving God on a consistent basis by faith, receiving the breath of life of the Holy Spirit, you know, through the word and sacrament, right? That's the covenant breaking is what causes the death to spread. Now, and what we do is we want to look and say, who can we blame for it? Right. But you really can't. I mean, the blame is on, you know, the generations of Christians that stopped trusting Jesus.
Well, part of the reason that we're looking for the blame is because we're trying to look, you blame the person who you think can fix it. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that we're looking to the point of blame somewhere over there because we're expecting them to be able to fix it. And instead of saying, okay, I don't care about who's to blame at this point. I really don't. I care about who's responsible from where we're at now to take control of the situation and make things right. And so, always put that right in the person who's actually able to operate.
Yeah. Cause there isn't a way for the government to fix this problem. They don't have the power to say, hey, let's put the family right.
That's what Moynihan was trying to do. And they couldn't fix it.
Right. And so,
that's what the welfare system was trying to do. That's what Social Security is trying to do. Yeah.
And that's always the promise. Hey, we got this problem. We can put it right. Right. We can throw money at it, whatever. We can put it right. I was just talking to my 18-year-old son, explaining to him how to build credit, because it was like, unless I buy a house really young, and start building equity, I'm never going to get one. Right. It's the housing market is completely shifted and changed. And so we're going through, what does it look like as an 18-year-old to start building credit so that he can, so when he's got money saved up, he can buy a piece of property. Right. So, that's not something that you give the government. That's not something that the government should be training my boys in, right? This is what just fathers and sons do, right? That you pass on the knowledge and the information of how the world really works, and you help you help him, you know, serve God and know who he is and all that. This is not a problem that is a lack of, that is a power issue. This is not a power
struggle. I don't think you can hit that point enough, Jason, because that is not how anybody is observing this. This is why J. Cole looks weak.
Right.
Because he's actually, I think if we just take this for what it is and he sees this, he's like, I don't believe this is a power issue. Then the first thing he's going to do is look weak. But then so this is where I'm trying to get to. So then what does strength actually look like, since we haven't seen it in a long time, if everybody's been playing this game for this long?
Right.
And then what is the right move then conservatives need to make at this point? I was talking to somebody about this, and one of the things that they brought up is like, Joe Biden has clearly struggled from dementia for a while.
Right.
And everybody knows it. And everybody has gone and said, hey, they're either tearing him down, which, you know, I get it, or they're acting like it doesn't exist. He's like, but wouldn't it be great if somebody got up and said, for whatever reason, our current president is representing us rightly in the sense that he has dementia, he's in the position of leadership, and nobody's acknowledging it, and everybody's making fun of him. Can we just stop for a minute and recognize that that's us, and that we need God to help us? So let's take this moment right now and let's pray for our president, that we would stop acting blind to his dementia and that we would stop treating our elders this way. And let's pray right now.
Right.
Right.
He's actually a good representative of us.
Right. Yeah. Of course he is. Yeah.
We are a people with dementia. We can't remember last year as a people.
Last right? week.
Last week. It's amazing our ability to, you know, just walk away from a situation, forget it, and get into a situation where that knowledge would help us of what happened a year ago, what happened. You know, I actually just saw somebody saying, I remember what it was like when President Trump was in office. I couldn't get toilet paper.
Yeah.
That's the kind of it. I was like, what?
Or I'm voting for President Trump because I like them Trump checks. I've heard that one.
Right. But you think, do you really not remember what happened? And they really can't. I mean, it's a very strange thing. And I think it's that's a curse, right? The memorylessness,
our own dementia
is a curse, right? I think a cultural dementia,
That's what idols do.
It is right. I think the real thing that we don't realize is that it's a that faithlessness is at the heart of all of these problems, right? Did we talk about the Vodi Bakum quote already?
Which one?
The one where he said the problem isn't that the church isn't doing a good job with the youth. It's that the church is doing something that only the family can do.
No, we haven't talked about that. You sent me that in a text message.
Yeah. And I love Vodi, right? But anytime somebody says that the problem is a works issue, my ire, the hair on the back of my neck stands up.
You had to pick the one brother in Reformdom to go against, right? You had to all the people to go against. You know, Vodi, I never had like Jason. We don't roll like that. We don't. So Vodi, you're right.
But he said, because I looked at it and I was like, well, now I don't know the context, but I just know a lot. I had a lot of friends sharing the quote, and what he says is the problem isn't, he says the problem is who's trying to do the works. If it was the family that did the works, the children would turn out. Right now, we let the church do the works when it's really the family that needs to be doing the works. The problem is always faith. It's not a, we don't have a works issue, right? We're not Pharisees, right? If our children aren't turning out, it's a faith issue, right? We don't raise our kids by works. We raise our kids by faith. And if we think that it's a works issue, we're going to end up either getting children twice the sons of hell as ourselves, like the Pharisees did, or we're going to get children that turn away from the Lord.
Yeah, I don't think I totally disagree with you on that.
I'd love to have that conversation.
Well, but here's the deal. And here's something that I would, because I want to say you're right. And yet, faith without works is dead.
Of course.
So, but right. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm not disagreeing with you. But that's true.
But when was the last time you heard somebody talking about raising kids by faith? Right, in the church. Where do we start saying the problem is? We immediately start talking about
who's doing
works.
It.
Who's doing it?
Because I think that's maybe I am. I think it's because that's presumption. We already assume that position. Like, you, of course, nobody's thinking like we're doing anything in works. I think everybody's thinking, of course, we're operating in faith. You don't believe that, though, do you?
No, I don't at all. I don't think we have a cosmology
that operates in faith.
Operates in faith, right?
I think what people are trying to say, especially when you're talking to a group of people that have their kids going to government school, well, you already proved the fact they're not operating in faith in that way. So I might be arguing against myself in this statement. but when you're talking to them, kind of what you're trying to do is to get them to understand that they're abdicating responsibility, because they wouldn't say that they're not operating in faith. Although, and this is, let me go around to the other side of the table and argue against myself. That's exactly what they're doing when they argue, I have no option but to send my kids to government schools, right? Right. When they argue that way, it's like, well, that's all I can do. It's like, but God told you not to do that. Right? God told you not to do that. So then that's all you think that you have the ability to do, but you haven't tried to operate in faith and say, Lord, I'm going to do it. Oh, I'm going to do what you told me to do. I'm going to raise my kids in the fear and admonition of the Lord. And then I'm going to trust you that you're going to make everything work from there on out, right? So I guess in one sense, you're right. But I don't think that's when you're talking to those people, I don't think that's you're trying to get them to understand that they're abdicating responsibility. And you would say they're abdicating responsibility because they don't have faith?
Yeah, I would say that abdication always flows out of faith. Not having faith, mm-hmm. right? And that it also works out over time too. So, right, you meet somebody, they might have faith and they're learning, right? They're raising their kids by faith and they're growing and they're changing. And so, you know, you meet them now, and then 3 years later, they are, you know, they have changed. The works have shifted and changed, but they had the faith, you know, back then, and they just hadn't learned. And
right.
That person is in a better spot if they have faith than somebody that has, you know, that's pulled their kids and they're doing they're using the right curriculum. They're doing everything, but they're doing it by works. Right. Because the kind of world that we live in is the kind of world that fights back against works-based parenting. What we need is,
well, it works based anything, right?
Like,
right,
it works based anything, and yeah, you know, we just haven't been talking about parenting, but right.
Wait, you gotta say that again, because that's a really what you just did was, we think that we can operate in God's world in operation against it and think that it's going to go good for us. Right.
Right. Because we think mechanistically. So we don't, and a mechanistic worldview, a mechanistic understanding of the world, acts out of fear, right? It does works out of fear. And, but we're called to have faith, right? To trust the Lord and to go into situations with joy, trusting that God is with us and is going to take care of us. And that he, the, so, but we live in a world that fights back against works-based parenting. So, so
can I frame that a different way? So here's what I wrote down. Operating faithless will have the world God made operate against you. Is right. that the right way to say? I think that is fantastic. Boy, but that covers everything.
It really does, right? And it's such a different, but it's a way of living that gets you in trouble with everyone, for one.
J. Cole's about to. Not saying that he's operating that way, but I'm just saying.
I don't know enough about him or know his story. He's a pretty private person, and so I don't actually even, I don't. When he says God, I don't know what
idol he's subscribing to.
Yeah, right. I mean, because as far as I know, I didn't think he was a Christian or anything.
Oh no,
I didn't think so. So
yeah.
He is basically stepping up and saying he's an example of somebody refusing, the system offered, right? And that's something that conservatives don't do, right? We don't refuse the system offered.
We figure if we can take the system, we can strong arm it and make it and bend it to our will to use it for good. It's like the ring in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Right. That Sauron wins no matter who picks up the ring.
Mm.
Right. Because the ring is built of his power. Right. And I think we're in that situation that we're being offered, or that the system is that's been built, and I think CRT is the current manifestation of that system. That system that's being built isn't a system that anybody should pick up and yield. You throw that thing into Mount Doom and watch it melt. But if you don't, I mean, this is where the genius of Tolkien is. That what made it possible for Sam to know that and understand that in those last moments was that he had a girl back home he wanted to get married to, and his small garden wouldn't survive, right? He just wanted to get home, marry one of the other hobbits and have a garden, right? As his desire set, he said, that is true life. That's what I'm after. Kept him from the temptations of the ring of power. And so when it was in front of him, he said, man, we'd all be better off without this system, because if I put this on, I can't get married and have a garden.
All right. You got 5 minutes. You still want to say anything else?
I just find it really frustrating, that there's so little self-awareness in this whole system, and just watching the way now people just are so easy to trigger. I see the right being played for with things like the announcement of a new Romeo and Juliet on Broadway. With the casting, they know all they have to do is put up a picture of a black person and a white person being cast in Romeo and Juliet, and they get all the free advertising they want, right? Because the conservatives are going to freak out as if critical race theory is true, right?
Well,
and say, you know, that sort of thing, right? So you think you're getting played by marketers, you're getting played every direction, right?
I got to challenge that a little bit, because I think you're right. I think they're using it that way, but they're also getting some people who are, it's amazing to me how much gamers are not trying to get inside this woke world. They're trying to, they care about the authenticity of their stories. They right. do in a real way. My kids have loved Avatar, and watching to see what Netflix has done with Avatar has made my kids reject watching anything from Avatar, because they destroyed, they merged two stories together in one episode. And my kids are like, down with these people. May they burn. You know, they're ruining the story. And I've appreciated, you know, it's made me look at this a little different, but I've appreciated their desire and burning for a narrative. It's what happens when I see Bible stories and I'm like, yo, that is not what happened in the text, you know? And I love the authenticity these people are calling for, because I'm like, I have hooks and that I can put inside you if you care for authenticity, right? Like, boom. Okay. If that's your narrative, but the same thing happens when you see people are like, okay, let's make the Black Panther the white dude now. And it's like, well, I don't know how much of this is critical race theory, but everybody's like, yeah, that don't feel right. They just ain't hitting the same way. And I'm not saying that they can't use it as a ploy to get the attention, and that some are doing it, but it's so intermingled with each other that it's hard to be able to really, you got to do brain surgery. And some of this feels like brain surgery with all sorts of different nerves in the way that you could cut, you know? Does that make sense? You know what I mean?
It does. Oh, totally.
So some of that I think is, but some of it is like, I don't know how to separate those two, who are people who are like, I really care for the story.
Right. But here's the thing is there are, if this is where I do think that playing into the definitions of the other side, right, mm-hmm. that there is something fundamentally different in the humanity of white people and black people.
Mm.
Right, that's not true.
Right,
that's not yeah. a that's not a category that we play in. Right, so
I was just thinking about that. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Right, so if you've got a story where it's about some sort of historical racial issue. The rise of the Black Panthers, right? Something like that, right? That you've got, then it'd be silly to cast a white person, although I think it'd be really funny. I love there's an old Eddie Murphy bit, and it's in Bowfinger, and it's in, he does it in interviews and stuff. He always pitches a fake TV show called Buck the Wonder Slave. And it's really funny, right? And Eddie Murphy's he's really funny, but the way that he always dealt with race was by leaning into the jokes that undermined it, right? Because he was a pure comedian, like the funniest thing was the point, and that was what made him so brilliant. And so he always would lean into the funny aspects. When you look at that and think about that, I think there's in a lot of ways, it's a foundationally Christian response that says, well, I'm not playing the game, right? And so with something like Romeo and Juliet, there's nothing fun that you need about that story that
demands it be
that demands the, I mean, the story is from before race was invented. Race is the modern category that we have was even invented, right? So there's nothing about, you know, in quote unquote interracial marriage. I don't think that's even a thing, right? I mean, if you're in the same species, then you can get married.
It's not, yeah,
right. Like that's not a thing that I think is, you know, an issue that as Christians that we die on that hill. What this shows is that the left has been able to get conservatives to buy into their categories and respond accordingly. Right. We have bought into their categorization, their divisions of the world, and responded accordingly and said, oh, there's a limited number of resources. And look, now they're taking Romeo and Juliet from us. Right. That's nonsensical. That is Shakespeare is the inheritance of all mankind. Right. It's part of the inheritance of the human race. And in Christ, all things are ours. Right. So this is not. It's not a competition for Shakespeare, right? Who gets to what's real Shakespeare? What's, and this is as dumb as, you know, who's the most reformed, you know, that sort of debate, right? It's as dumb as that, right? What it comes down to is you've got this division that is being sown, and because our fundamental assumptions about the world are the same, we're being, you know, carried around by the nose. Or
we gotta continue to be on that, because I think that's a good point. When you said who's more reformed, when I became reformed, I was chasing that question.
Yeah, what's the true reformation? Who's the most reformed? How can I be?
And I want to be around those people. And there's different reasons for why, but I think that it does pit in the same way folks against each other in the same mechanistic reality that we get from the critical race theory. All right. So what is it then to not, maybe we'd work about this next time. Okay. Next time I want to talk about, I think we've talked a little bit about this, but could we work out places that you think we're taking the bait at and the return response that we probably need to have? Because I don't think, and I'm not saying that they have to be like, but we have to see the parallel between the two. Cause I don't think we notice when we're actually being set up to take the bait.
Right. Yeah.
And matter of fact, for whatever the reality is, I don't think J. Cole noticed it either. He did the thing and then he came back and he was like, that was wrong. Like, yeah. Whatever that was, like, that was wrong. I shouldn't have done that because I gave. And boy, he's being really bold because he even said my own team and my own people are like, yo, what are you doing? Right. And so it's kind of, that's why I'm not so quick to say, oh, he's gotten like, the game's gotten, we do have softness is happening amongst us. And yeah, all this is a reality, but to do what he did is not a soft move, because he's going against everybody, including Kendrick Lamar. And he's saving Kendrick. He's like, whatever you have to do. And I was thinking to myself, like, man, that's a whole, I couldn't imagine. Is it the bigger story that he didn't kill his brother?
Yeah.
Like,
right. You've got a Cain and Abel scenario. And he said, oh, man, look, sin is crouching at the door. I'm going to stop.
Right. Right. which is really weird in the culture to see something like that. That's what's so odd about this. It's like, you don't see this. You don't see this in hardly anywhere. You don't see this hardly anywhere. Anyway. All right. We'll talk more about that next week. Anything else you wanted to say?
No, I'm good.
All right. Man, we needed more time. I got to run, though, because I got other things to knock out. But I could have talked about this for about another hour, because there's so many things to work through on this. And it has to. I'm convinced a lot of the conversations that we've had, I'm convinced that all these conversations for me at the root place to start at is always in parenting. I have to help my kids see it's not either or. It's not either or, right? Yeah. It's not, right. Like this is how do you win your brother? How do you save your brother? How do you not take the bait? You know, there's at the same time what it looks like to be bold too.
Right. Well, I'd love to talk maybe next time about how as a church to approach your city with this mindset. Because I think that conservative churches right now are all in defense mode, and we don't know what it looks like to shift into offense with this all being true, because it's a huge opportunity to shift into offense when you are the only one that knows how the world really works.
Yeah. Right?
That you have this wisdom that says, oh, actually we're all covenantally connected by the historical reality of the covenant of our city. Yeah. And that means, and you don't understand that. I do. How that means that it could be one generation before we're in charge for the betterment of the city here. Just by shifting into offensive mode. But we instead back up into defense, and you know, we're setting up out. We think there's a snowball fight coming, so we're building our fort rather than saying, oh, we're the only ones that know how this system works. So,
all right, that's next time.
Yeah.